Hey, from the tech desk in, where else? Brussels, Belgium. It's Clark. And it's time for episode number 326 of the Best Kept Secret in Podcasting. That's right, it's the World's Technology Podcast. Now, The World, for those of you who haven't heard this before, is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Public Radio in Boston. We also have a lot of other fantastic audio offerings. Find out more about all of it at theworld.org. Now, while we're talking about websites, I should just mention that my colleague over at the World Science Podcast, Ritu Chatterjee, and I have joined forces online. That's right. We've combined our science and tech coverage into one easy-to-use web page, and you can find that at theworld.org/technology. Don't worry, it's the same old link. I don't want to change the link. So theworld.org/technology will take you to our new SciTech page, and you can check out Ritu's podcast. You can check out our podcast. That's the place to get show notes. It's the place to find links to both of us on Twitter and Facebook. It's one-stop shopping for all your global science and technology needs. Speaking of technology needs, there's nothing like coming back from vacation and flipping on your computer and finding that it is, not flipping on, dead. It's one of the hazards of working in the biz, right? Yeah. We're dependent on the technology. Anyway, luckily, all the files that I need to do podcast 326 were savable. So you're still getting a podcast this week. Yay. And it's a good one, too, I have to say. Let's start off with biofuels. You may remember a while back, especially if you follow us on Facebook, that I was saying that we had an upcoming piece that was going to feature the sounds of 4,000 tons or so of garbage and what that sounds like, both in its garbage state and after it's been liquefied. Yeah, that's right. So you'll want to take a listen to this. This is my piece on second-generation biofuels from Denmark. Here we go.
1 year ago, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig burst into flames off the coast of Louisiana. The explosion killed 11 workers and spewed 206 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. The disaster brought more urgency to the search for alternatives to fossil fuels. One such option is biofuels, but most biofuels are made from crops, and turning food into fuel puts pressure on food supplies and land resources. So researchers are trying to create fuel from other kinds of plant matter. It's been a tough nut to crack. The World's Clark Boyd reports, though, that one Danish company thinks it may have done it.
Farms and wind turbines dominate the landscape in the town of Kalundborg, about 70 miles west of Copenhagen. But there's also industry here. There's a giant coal-fired power plant. And next to that, a shiny, state-of-the-art biofuel factory.
Yeah, this is what we call the soaker, where we put in some water.
Niels Henriksen runs Invacon, a spin-off of Denmark's national energy company. He's showing me the works of one of the first plants in the world to produce so-called second-generation ethanol. Instead of corn or soybeans like traditional ethanol, the fuel here is produced from agricultural waste.
So what we see here is the flow coming in from the storage.
It's potentially a big breakthrough that has more to do with serendipity than anything else. Henriksen says that in the mid-1990s, Denmark ordered its coal-fired power plants to also burn 1 million tons of straw a year. The idea was to use waste from Danish farms to help reduce the country's demand for fossil fuels. But it turned out that the straw harmed the furnaces. So, Henriksen says, Invacon started experimenting with ways to pre-treat it.
Nature have over a million of years developed the plant so it can protect itself from weather and microorganisms and things like that. And that's a challenge, to break down the structure.
Eventually, they found a solution in the magic of chemistry: natural enzymes that could break down the rough fibers in the straw. The enzymes worked so well that the company thought, why just burn the processed straw to make electricity? Why not use it to make liquid fuel? So that's what the Kalundborg plant does.
This is the hydrolysis tank.
Henriksen stands above a large rotating tank. Straw, tons of it, is soaked in water and then cooked at temperatures close to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. The resulting mash is fed into this tank. The magic enzymes are added, and after about 6 hours, you've got a liquid full of sugars that can be fermented. Sound or smell familiar?
It has a very nice smell of port wine, but I do not recommend it to drink it.
After fermentation, the liquid is distilled into ethanol that's added to gasoline. The demonstration plant can process 4 tons of straw per hour. Henriksen says a commercial plant would be 10 times this size and could be built just about anywhere.
We are trying to sell licenses on our technology worldwide. Ethanol is a fuel that can be produced by a lot of countries.
The European Union wants 10% of its transport energy to come from renewable sources by 2020. And the big selling point for second-generation biofuels is that they can help meet goals like this without using food crops. Invacon is hoping its new plant will show that the technology is viable. But not everyone is convinced.
It's going to be a challenge to really increase second-generation biofuel production massively by 2020.
Jan Erik Petersen is a bioenergy expert with the European Environmental Agency in Copenhagen.
It's very difficult technology biologically and also in terms of the transport logistics, etc. You have a lot of volume for a relatively small amount of energy. So it's difficult to have an efficient process.
To be honest, I and most other environmental scientists who look at this issue are puzzled as to why society is so focused on ethanol.
That's Bob Howarth of Cornell University. Howarth chairs an international effort to study the effects of biofuel production on the environment. He says the jury is still out on second-generation ethanol.
It's not a particularly good fuel. You're stuck with the energetics of trying to distill it and all the environmental costs associated with that. In many cases, we feel that you're better off using the feedstock material and directly burning it to cogenerate heat and electricity.
Which, of course, is what Invacon set out to do in the first place. But the company thinks it can make the new ethanol technology environmentally sound and profitable. They're looking to increase its value by turning waste from the process into fuel pellets and livestock feed. And they're hoping the same enzyme technology will also work with garbage. Inside this giant trash facility near Copenhagen, there's a small pilot plant where enzymes are turning garbage into liquid. Johnny Trapp Stephenson, a manager for the energy company Renascience, says the liquid could be used to fuel a power plant. He also says the company's working on a way to turn it into, you guessed it, ethanol.
We all need to have alternatives to fossil fuels. And in addition, of course, also we are probably in for some climate changes, and we might as well get on with trying to find ways to avoid the impact.
If the process works, Stephenson says a commercial unit could process 70 to 80,000 tons of garbage a year into fuel. For The World, this is Clark Boyd, Copenhagen. Now, of course, biofuels aren't just being put forward as one of the green fuel choices for the developed world. There are also movements afoot in the developing world as well. This piece comes in from Kenya by the BBC's Will Ross.
Inside a thatched mud hut, an elderly woman grinds corn between two large circular stones. Life in this village hasn't changed much in years. There's no piped water and no electricity. But now people living here in the Dakacha woodlands of Kenya are worried that they're about to lose their land as an Italian company tries to set up a 50,000-hectare biofuels plantation. Sitting under the shade of a tree, Joshua Pekeche is sounding defiant.
I'm not happy because they want to take our land and use it to grow their crop. They want to use the county council to grab our land. The new constitution recognizes this as community land, so nobody can take it away without our consent. We are not going to let this land go, even if it means shedding blood. This is our land.
Recently, there have been plenty of examples of foreign companies leasing huge tracts of farmland in Africa to grow biofuels for use as an alternative source of energy in Europe. The deals are rarely transparent and often have been struck in countries where there are food shortages, leading some to ask, why feed a car in Europe with fuel when you don't have enough food for your own family?
What is 5N-3?
In a very rural primary school, I stumbled across an algebra lesson.
If we open the brackets here, we take 3 multiplied by...
When I left the students to struggle with the brackets and the X's and the Y's, and outside I found this signboard.
Mulunguni Primary School. I'm just standing outside it here, and there's a big sign that says, the proposed funding of construction and equipping of 4 new classrooms, 10 pit latrines, 30 tables, 60 benches, 4 teachers' tables and 4 teachers' chairs. And this was financed by the European Union.
And ironically, decisions made by the politicians from the same European Union have led to fears that this primary school will soon be forced to close. As part of an energy policy, EU countries have committed to ensuring that by 2020, at least 20% of energy should be from renewable sources. Without the available land in Europe, companies have turned to Africa to grow biofuels to help meet this target.
My name is Godfrey Karisa. I'm the deputy head teacher here at Mulunguni Primary School.
There's the school bell just going. Now, what do you know about the plan in this area to create a big farm for a new crop?
I don't think it is so good, because if they are displaced, the school will be empty, because their parents will be far away from the school, which will be not so good for the community. We want something which will benefit the community direct.
If this farm, this very large farm, were to create jobs, would that be a good thing?
It would be a good thing, yes, but a farm without a home is not good. You need to have a home before you go to job.
The Italian company Nuove Iniziative Industriali is behind the proposed plantation of the biofuel crop Jatropha in Kenya. It says it's already leased around 1 million hectares across Africa. But local conservation groups warn that if the Kenyan project goes ahead, endangered bird species would face extinction and close to 20,000 people would be faced with eviction. On the phone to the company base in Milan, I asked Girardello Adriano if his project would indeed lead to this displacement.
No, absolutely no, absolutely no. So we're helping these people, absolutely, because in case these people won't work in for the company, you are welcome, no problem. Take the people, moving the house. No, absolutely no.
The company promises to create hundreds of permanent and thousands of seasonal jobs in Kenya. But now the whole viability of the project is being questioned, as new research says the Jatropha crop is not a green source of energy at all. And there are calls for the EU to rethink its policy, which is causing these huge biofuel plantations to be set up in Africa. Chris Coxon works for the campaign group ActionAid.
Jatropha grown in the Dikacha woodlands will release up to 6 times the amount of carbon dioxide when compared with traditional fossil fuels. So it shows that these EU policies are foolish policies, because they're just not reducing greenhouse gas emissions as the EU is proclaiming.
On the small farm holdings of the Dikacha woodlands, people wonder if they'll be safe on their land and will they get jobs. Their fate is in the hands of the Kenyan government. It's not surprising they're worried. Kenya's politicians do not have a good track record when it comes to working in the interests of the people.
The BBC's Will Ross there. Now, you can find more information about both of those pieces at theworld.org/technology. Just come along to the show notes. We have some links to some pictures from both Kenya and Denmark for you to check out. So be sure to stop on by theworld.org/technology. Okay, now here's an important milestone that we're celebrating this week. It's been 50 years since an electronics engineer got a patent for something he developed called a silicon integrated circuit. Now, you might not think you've heard of it, but you have. And it's because you and I know it as anyone, Bueller, the microchip. The BBC spoke with Steve Ferber, professor of computer engineering at Manchester University, and he told the BBC what life was like before the dawn of the digital age.
Clearly, we used to survive without microchips before they were available. But life, I think, was lived at a much slower pace, with far less available by way of entertainment and communication. Banking was much harder work before the days of computers and so on.
So we would be getting up in the morning with a digital alarm clock. Do you need a microchip for that?
I think most digital alarm clocks will have a microchip in, yes.
Okay, so we'd be getting up in the morning with the help of a sort of wind-up alarm clock. Then if we had to get money out, we'd have to actually go and see a person. We wouldn't be able to use a cash machine. What else?
If we wish to watch television, of course, we'd have to go back to analog TV, which at least in my part of the country has ceased to exist. We'd have to listen to analog radio, which is actually still fairly common, but is on its way out. If we wanted to know what was happening in the world, I guess we'd have to buy a newspaper. We couldn't go to our nearest web browser and look at the BBC website.
What about all the ways that this information is gathered in the first place? I mean, for example, we've been having very sunny days, unusually hot days here in Britain. The weather reports, you know, finding out what's going to happen in the weather, does that rely on microchip technology too?
Certainly the weather forecasters rely on big computers based on very large numbers of microchips entirely these days to create their weather forecasts. So weather forecasting has become much more reliable as we've had bigger computers to compute more detailed models further into the future.
And where is the microchip going to take our lives in the future?
Well, the microchip has enjoyed 50 years of extremely rapid development. The cost effectiveness of microchips has doubled every 18 months to 2 years for 50 years. And if you keep doubling at that rate for 50 years, then you go from the very earliest microchips, which had maybe 10 switching devices on them, today's chips, which have 1,000 million devices on. And that progress is continuing, although there are clear signs that the next 10 years are going to be much harder than the last 10 years.
Why are the next 10 years going to be much harder?
The way we've got more and more devices on a transistor is by shrinking those devices. So today's leading-edge technology uses transistors which are the order of 100 atoms across. And as we keep shrinking, we go down from that number and the physics becomes very difficult as the number of atoms becomes smaller.
Does that mean that the microchip might be overtaken, might be replaced by something else?
There is the potential in the longer term that some new technology will come in and displace the microchip. There are a number of candidates sitting in the wings.
What are they?
Colleagues of mine at Manchester were awarded the Nobel Prize recently for their discovery of graphene. And graphene offers a technology which has very interesting electronic properties. But we're a very long way from being able to manufacture 1,000 million graphene devices on a chip in any sort of economic way. So I think these new technologies are not poised to take over in the next 10 or 20 years. They're further out than that.
But can you imagine a day when the microchip is looked at as something so cumbersome and obsolete, like, I don't know, a bicycle made of solid wood?
That may well happen, but I don't think it'll be in my lifetime.
Computer engineering professor Steve Ferber there. All right. Of course, the microchip is a stunning success. But let's face it, 9 times out of 10, there's a lot of failure, right? Now, we had the special podcast a few episodes back where I played the entire conversation with Catherine Schultz, the author of Being Wrong, Adventures on the Margin of Error. Well, and I told you that there would be more failure to come, and indeed there is. In fact, we've got, it's not just your bog standard failure. It is, in fact, brilliant failure that we're going to be talking about. Here is, finally, the piece that I did from Amsterdam on the Institute of Brilliant Failures, where their motto is, failure is an option. Here we go. A boat ride through Amsterdam's canals is a testament to Holland's many successes. The Dutch beat back the sea with canals, dams, and dikes. They created a thriving city of trade and commerce and made a global name for themselves.
In the course of the centuries, Amsterdam has expanded into an international center of culture, trade, industry, and ocean and air travel.
And so it's a bit strange to find that Amsterdam is also home to the world's one and only Institute of Brilliant Failures.
If you look at the history of the Netherlands, it's very much a country of control and managing.
Paul Iske is the Institute's president. He says while the Dutch love that feeling of control, it's unrealistic in today's world.
And that gives a lot of people in the Netherlands a very nice feeling. We are in control. And the world is now very, very complex. Nobody can be in control. And it's now more a matter of navigation. And especially in this country, we need this change of thinking.
A few years back, Iske, a professor in business innovation, was doing research on business people in Holland who went through bankruptcy. He found that many were so traumatized and stigmatized that they never tried to start a business again. But those that did, Iske says, often succeeded because their failures had taught them something. Iske wanted to help others embrace failure. So he started the Institute and began offering failure workshops to businesses and organizations. There's also a website where anyone can nominate a brilliant failure in business, art, science, whatever. Of course, we're not talking about tripping over a shoelace kind of stuff. Brilliance in failing has to meet certain criteria, Iske says.
What we define as a brilliant failure is something that has been tried with very good intentions. And of course, they experience something that is different than from what they try to achieve. That's the failure part. And the brilliant part is that we can learn something from it. In the worst case scenario, the only thing you learn is that this was not the way to do it. And in the best case, you learn something totally different that you even didn't expect.
Iska's favorite example of this kind of serendipity is Viagra.
Don't let erectile dysfunction get in the way.
Viagra was originally developed as a heart medication, but it's the drug's side effects that have made it a winner. Another of Iska's favorite brilliant failures is homegrown. It involves Holland's beloved speed skating. You might remember that Dutch skater Sven Kramer was expected to win gold in the 10,000 meters in the Vancouver Winter Games last year. Kramer was well out in front, and then his coach mistakenly told him to change lanes at the wrong time, leading to a disqualification. Kramer relived the moment in this documentary on Dutch television.
Ik was bezig met de beste 10 kilometer van mijn leven.
At the end of the day, Kramer said, I'm responsible for the things I do. I find it difficult to accuse other people. So what turned a major blunder into a brilliant failure for Sven Kramer? His sportsmanlike way of dealing with defeat won him fans worldwide. Kramer's coach failed brilliantly as well. He now gives master classes to companies on dealing with disappointment. But is all this focus on failing a bit too, well, defeatist?
We are living in this interesting moment of what I've been sort of jokingly referring to as kind of a wrongness zeitgeist or a failure zeitgeist.
Catherine Schultz is author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. She says sharing failures is becoming increasingly popular. Engineers Without Borders in Canada, for example, has launched a website called Admitting Failure. Schultz says that's fine, as long as people really are learning from their mistakes.
I worry that it is easy to pay lip service to the sort of glory of wrongness. You know, yeah, we all make mistakes and things fail and they go awry and sort of talk that talk and yet not really grapple with the deep issue, which is, okay, so what are the emotional consequences of that? What are the material consequences, the financial consequences?
The Institute of Brilliant Failures, though, is urging people to dig deep. Again, Paul Iska.
People do not feel that freedom to experiment, more or less the freedom that we have as children. When children fail, we all applaud and we say, okay, you learn something. And somehow we lose that tolerance when people grow up.
Iska says his research shows that the first step toward reclaiming that childlike freedom to fail is laughter. The next time you screw up, he says, you can start by laughing it off. For The World, this is Clark Boyd, Amsterdam. And folks, that will wrap things up for podcast 326. As always, we invite you to come along to the show notes and check out their beautiful new home. It's the same URL. It's theworld.org/technology, but it will take you to the world's newly minted SciTech page. That's right, we've combined our science and our technology coverage into one place for you. You can check out my colleague Ritu Chatterjee's excellent podcast. Also participate in our various science and technology forums that we run there. Lots of good stuff. Also find links to us there on Twitter and Facebook. If you're interested in following us through social media, I keep a Facebook fan page at World's Tech Pod. And that also happens to be our Twitter handle, World's Tech Pod. Of course, you can always email me, Clark, C-L-A-R-K.Boyd, B-O-Y-D, at bbc.co.uk. All right. Next week, I'll be coming at you from the old stomping grounds. That's right, I'll be back in Boston. So we'll do a podcast from there. Okay, until then, this is me wishing you a very pleasant and technology-filled week. Bye-bye.
Support for the World's Technology Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.